we believe strongly, and I think I learned this mostly from Dr. Leibovitz. Dr. Leibovitz often says, and he has his monthly Jewish medical ethics sessions on the first Wednesday of every month. He often says that, you know, he has a deal with the rabbis in town. He's a doctor, you know, he says, I have a deal. You say it. What's your deal with them?
I tell them, you don't write prescriptions, and I don't say what the Jewish law is.
Right, exactly. So we believe strongly that there's a need for a partnership between the local rabbis and what Jewish law says and the doctors on each side. That we can all work together. And so that we have experts in both areas, and we recognize that everyone has their own area of expertise. So when I heard that we had a special guest to Los Angeles coming, I wanted to bring him in for the following reason. You know, here's the case we had. I'll tell you the case, and then we'll introduce our speaker, and I'll let him go straight in and explain why this was important. We had a case which probably happens once a week at least. We had a patient come into the hospital who was an elderly woman who fell at home. And even though she had an advance directive that she did not want to be resuscitated, she was intubated in the emergency room, I think, and came up to the ICU with very poor neurological function, very weak, very little positive signs, but she was intubated. And the doctors, the team, gave her family a choice, the choice that they're often given, which was, either in about 2 weeks, you're going to have to extubate, because she can't stay intubated forever, in which case she would likely die, or you could put in a trach and keep her alive, though she might be a vegetable for many years in an institution. Which would you choose? Now, oftentimes the Orthodox families choose to put in the trach because they don't want to extubate, which might be seen as causing the patient to die. In this case, a senior rabbinic authority was contacted, and he said something totally different. He said, "We have a principle in Jewish law, sheva al tase. Sometimes it's better to just do nothing." So even though one of the choices was not to leave the tube in, it was either you extubate or put in a trach, he said, "Why don't you just leave the tube in? Leave it in and then see what happens. We'll just pull back." So that's what they did, even though everyone was surprised by this. And she moved to a vent floor, and a few weeks later, her blood pressure dropped one day, and she was allowed to die, but still intubated. So a number of people asked me afterwards, right after that, "Where does this principle? Can you explain this principle in Jewish law?" And this came right down to the point of this case was exactly, the rabbis were ruling what to do. They needed the input of the doctors, so we needed the doctors on the one hand and the rabbinic input, and it worked together. But the doctors wanted to know then. So what is? Where does this principle come from? So that then, not that I want to push off my own job responsibilities, but right then I heard that we had a visitor coming to town. Now, who is this visitor? So thanks to this thing, I listen to about probably 10 hours of lectures in Torah a week. And I listen when I'm driving and when I'm jogging. So I had to find somebody who, I have a short attention span. If someone's boring or is too simplistic, I can't listen. But on the other hand, when you're driving, when you're running, you can't really, you need someone to be very, very clear, very, very focused. So I had to find someone who was very sophisticated, very learned, and also very organized, very clear. And voila, Rabbi Shai Schechter gives beautiful, beautiful shiur and beautiful lectures. And when I heard he was coming to town, I thought, this is a perfect opportunity to have someone who's an expert in Torah. We're not trying to claim that he is a medical ethics expert. We're asking someone who can explain a concept in Jewish law that will explain why the rabbis made the decision that they made. And the doctors will give us the medical side, and we want Rabbi Schechter to provide the rabbinical side. So I don't want to have any further ado. It's an honor to call up someone who's a great rabbinic authority, someone who's sophisticated, but also clear, and also a mensch, just a really good person. Some of you might be thinking, I told you about how we have this great rabbinic leader coming to town. You might be looking at him and say, how old is he? Which is something, I just say that because I hear that all the time. This is why I grew the beard. But we have a principle in the Torah, Al tistakel b'kan kan el b'mashi yeshbo. Look at not what's on the externals, look at what's inside, what content. And as we say in Yiddish, he really has what to say. So we have no any further ado, Rabbi Schechter.
I think everyone can judge for themselves. Don't trust the rabbi for anything. Okay, let's jump straight into our discussion for this morning. First of all, thank you very much. It's really an honor for me to be here. And it's actually my first time ever speaking in Los Angeles, so it's an interesting opportunity for me, and it's very nice to meet all of you. This case that the rabbi sent me a couple of weeks ago is something which is obviously very difficult for anybody to deal with. It's difficult for a rabbi, and it's obviously difficult for a doctor as well. I think that I feel very blessed in my life. My father is one of the greatest rabbinic authorities in North America. I don't know if any of you have heard of him, Rabbi Herschel Schechter. And I feel very privileged that when these kind of questions come up, I have the opportunity to discuss them with him and get his advice, get his input, and find out exactly what the halacha, what the Jewish law requires of us to do in such cases. Much of what I'm going to say today, obviously, I have been trained by him. I have been very much influenced by his train of thought and by his style of speech. And very much of what I'm going to say today is reflective of his opinion on these type of matters. So let's get straight into our discussion. Very often, and the title that I gave for it is Confronting Halachic Conundrums, because I don't think that this is a particular problem when we deal with end-of-life issues. I think this is something that is a lot more far-reaching than just questions that come up that arise in a hospital. I welcome everybody's comments. Maybe we'll just give a couple of minutes to get into the discussion first, and then as we go on, maybe we'll take more time for questions and comments, unless someone has a immediate problem which is stopping them from understanding what I'm saying. So very often we are faced with a halachic dilemma. Often we are faced with something which we call in Jewish law as a bayah hilchatit. We have something which we just cannot figure out what to do. A dilemma means, in either direction, whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to have a problem. That's generally the way we understand a dilemma. Dilemma doesn't mean do this and you'll be fine, do that, you won't be fine. That's not a dilemma. Then you obviously do this and you'll be fine. A dilemma means in either direction I'm going to have a problem. The question is, how do I decide which way I'm supposed to act when I have this type of issue, when I have a dilemma that faces me in such a way? There's one of the greats of the last generation. Unfortunately, he passed away in the Holocaust. His name is Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. He lived in Europe. He was a great Talmudic scholar and a great Rosh Yeshiva. He was the head of a great institution in Europe. So he writes the following idea, based on a lot of sources in the Rishonim, in the earlier context in Jewish literature, but he writes the following idea. We all know, I mean, many of us are probably familiar, that there are three shalosh averus chamuros. Generally, we say that when a person has, God tells him to do X, but it's at the expense of my life. It's at the expense of my life. Take, for example, somebody comes to me and puts a gun to my head and says, I want you to steal all his money. So should I go ahead and steal the money, or should I say, well, God says I'm not allowed to steal his money. What am I supposed to do? Obviously, the answer is, go steal his money, although I'm uncomfortable with stealing his money, but if it's at the expense of my own life, obviously I don't have to give up my life for your money. Take a bunch of other examples, if you could just imagine examples like that. Obviously, we always assume that pikuach nefesh, which means the saving of a person's life, is always something that we take with utmost seriousness, and it's something that we don't allow just to be taken over by any mitzvah in the Torah. There are three exceptions to this rule. Exception number one is if a person comes over to me, holds a gun to my head, and says, I would like you to serve Avodah Zarah. I would like you to serve another god. That is something I cannot give up on my principles. I have to be able to give up my life in order to save myself from serving another religion. That is case number one. Number two that we find is Gili Arayus. If somebody comes to me and says, I would like you to have relations, to have, you know, some sort of relation with this and this woman. This woman is a married woman. It's someone you are generally not allowed to be with. And he says, this is at the expense of your life. I must be willing to give up my life instead of having to go ahead and have relations with this person I'm not allowed to have relations with. And number three is Pikuach Nefesh. If somebody comes to me, holds a gun to my head and says, please kill this individual or else I will kill you. This happened very often in the Holocaust. We know very unfortunate stories of where this played out. But if you have a situation like that, the Gemara tells us as well that the halacha is a person has to be willing to give up his life and not transgress the violation of lo sirtzach. I'm not allowed to kill somebody else at the expense of my own life. Says the Gemara, why is this true? Don't we know that human life is very important? Don't we know that I should value my own life? I shouldn't be willing to give it up. And what do I care if they're telling me to kill somebody else? Well, says Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, the explanation is, based on the Gemara sources, but basically the way he explains it is that over here we're faced with a dilemma. On the one hand, I'm going to have to give up my own life. On the other hand, I'm going to have to take away someone else's life. So what do I do when I'm faced with a dilemma? How do I act? So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman explains, Shev va'altas, be passive, and that is the best way to deal with the problem. We have on the one hand my life, on the other hand somebody else's life. So how do I act when I have such a situation? Says Rabbi Chanan, this is what the Gemara means, Shev va'altas. This is what the Talmud tells us, just be passive. Don't do any activity. That is the best way to deal with the dilemma at hand. Okay, is that clear so far? So that's number one. That's something that we find in... That's something that we find that although we do value life very much, and although obviously I'm supposed to value my own life and I have to look out for myself, but when it comes at the expense of somebody else's life, that's something that we have to take with utmost seriousness, and I have to be willing to give up my own life in order not to actively kill somebody else. So that's number one. This would seem to indicate, just taking this in its own little bubble, it would seem to indicate that any time a person is faced with a dilemma, the best thing to do is just be passive, right? Because instead of being active, why should I actively go ahead and do a maisa, as we call it? Why should I actively go ahead and carry out an activity which may be frowned upon? Why not just be passive, and that will be the smartest way of getting around the dilemma? Now, this is not so simple. If you look in the source sheet of number one, for those who can read Hebrew, you can follow along. For those who can't, we'll translate as we go. So this is also another snippet from Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, the same individual we were quoting before, but he has the fundamental question which really is going to be the heart of our discussion today. Says Rabbi Chanan, for those who can follow us, Hadim al-Chalkinan ben kumba asay l'sheva al-tasa. We all know that there is a difference. Don't worry, there's English on the other side for some sources that we'll get to later. Hopefully we'll have enough time, but I think we're going to have a good time this morning. So, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman points out the following. This, that we know there is a distinction between kumva asay and sheva al tase. There is a difference between being active and being passive. Anyone who's a thinking person understands that there's a difference, right? We all know there's a difference. So what precisely is that difference? Ask Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, how do we define that difference? Says Rabbi Chanan, if we could look on the sheet, im hadavar tali bedargas chomar ha'iser. Is it that we consider being active, is that more severe than just being passive? Is that why we tell a person, you may as well stay passive, because why do something which is more severe? You may as well do something which is less severe. So just be passive. Is that why we assume that being passive is better? Because it's less severe? Or because do we say, in truth, we don't assume at all that being active is considered more severe than being passive. And why do we say that there's a split between being active and being passive? It's because I have a halachic dilemma. I have a problem, I'm confronted with an issue, and I don't know which way to turn, and therefore, sheva al tasa adav. So this is the fundamental question when we discuss all of these types of issues, whenever we have a dilemma. Why do we assume that sometimes it's best to be passive? Is it because, and we'll bring a proof text in a minute, is it because we assume that being passive is less severe, and therefore that's the best way to go? Or do we assume that no? Both being active and being passive have the same severity. They have the same seriousness. The only issue is, if I'm going to be active, that's a danger to do. It's better just to be passive, and this way I can say, look, I didn't do anything. So that's the question. Now, some people might say this is sort of a question in the clouds. You know, what's the difference if you assume like this or you assume like that? Bottom line, just be passive. Well, what if we come up with a scenario where... We'll bring a proof to this. What if we come up with a scenario where it actually make a difference, a nafka mina, as we call it in halacha? What if we come up with a scenario where it will actually make a difference that will play out between these two very fundamental options that we have in front of us in understanding why being passive is better than being active? Are we okay so far? Everyone's following? Excellent. Okay, if not, please feel free to speak up. So let's look at a Gemara in Erevin Daf Kuf. This is a tractate in Erevin on page 100a. So the Gemara tells us as follows. We have, just to give a little background, a little context, where this Gemara is coming from. This is number 2 on the source sheet for those who are following. So the Gemara tells us that there are many different offerings that are offered in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash. Some offerings, as we know, need to have their blood sprinkled on the Mizbeach, on the altar, 4 times. Other offerings need to have their blood sprinkled only 1 time. So the Gemara discusses, what happens if I have 2 different offerings, 2 different individuals, offering karbanos together, offering sacrifices together. One comes 5 minutes earlier, one comes 5 minutes later, and now you have a priest, you have a kohen who's there, ready to sprinkle the blood on the altar. Suddenly, both of these cups of blood get mixed together. So what happens? If both people who are here to offer their sacrifices, both brought the types of karbanos, both brought the types of offerings that need to be sprinkled four times. So, would you call that a dilemma? No, you're absolutely right. That's not a dilemma, because the priest may as well just go and sprinkle the blood four times and take care of both of them. No problem. Right? So far, so good. Now, what happens if we have two individuals who come to the temple, each one offers a sacrifice, and each one of those sacrifices needs to be sprinkled on the altar once? Now, both cups of blood gets mixed together. Would you call that a dilemma? No, why not? Sprinkle it once. Either way, you're fine, right? Because both sacrifices had the same halacha, had the same mandate that they had to be sprinkled once. So you sprinkle once and you're fine. Now, says the Gemara, what happens if you're faced with the following issue? On the one hand, you have an individual who comes with a sacrifice that needs to be sprinkled four times. Right next to him, you have an individual who comes with a sacrifice that needs to be sprinkled on the altar one time. I have these two cups of blood, four times in this hand. I have the cup of blood with one time in this hand. Now these two cups get mixed together. Now what do? Do you call that a dilemma?
No.
Why not?
Because you're taking care of the one sprinkle for the both bloods that have been mixed.
Oh, so let me ask you. A good point. But now, what do you do if, in fact, I was supposed to sprinkle this four times? It turns out I didn't do what I was supposed to do because I only did it once. So I would call that a dilemma. If I just stop at one, then I only took care of this man's sacrifice, I didn't take care of this one's. If I do it four, then I only took care of this one's, and I didn't properly take care of this man's sacrifice. So this is what we would actually call a dilemma. So let's see, how does the Gemara understand, how does the tractate tell us to act in such a case? Well, what would you say, according to the background that we've given, what would you say to do? Sheva al tasa, which means be passive. So what should you do in such a case? I have a cup of blood that has four sprinklings in one hand, a cup of blood that's supposed to be sprinkled one time in the other hand. Now they get mixed together. What should I do? How many times should I sprinkle on the altar? Simple mathematics. What would we say? Five? Start again. If you say, what? Okay, let's try this again. If you say that being passive is the way to go, here I have on the one hand a cup that's supposed to be sprinkled four times on the altar. Gets mixed with a cup that's supposed to be sprinkled one time on the altar. They get mixed together. Being passive would tell me to act in which way?
Once.
Excellent. You're just supposed to sprinkle once. And this way, you save yourself. This way, you didn't do actively anything you weren't supposed to do. So this is, in fact, a discussion in the Gemara. Is that, in fact, the case? Should you go ahead and sprinkle it once, because that's being passive? Or should you go ahead and sprinkle it four times? Why would you sprinkle four times?
Because then you're getting the one in there too.
Yeah, but now you're not acting in a passive way. Now you're actively doing something wrong, possibly. So here, you're correct. There are two opinions in the tractate. Not sure if you looked at this before. But there are two opinions in the tractate. The Gemara is not sure, should you sprinkle once or should you sprinkle four times? Well, I ask everyone in the room, why not be passive? So my father likes to point out that you see from this text, you see from this case, that not always do we assume in a dilemma that the best way out is just to be passive. I think it's a very clear indication that we see from this tractate. You have this case, it's a little bit of an obscure case, it's a little bit hard for us to imagine because we don't have an altar and we don't have a temple, so it's hard for us to imagine the case exactly, but just theoretically thinking about it, the Gemara, the tractate does not assume that being passive is the way to go. The Gemara is not sure. In fact, maybe we should be active. Maybe that's the best way to go. Maybe be passive. Maybe that's the way to go. And the Gemara turns out that this seems to be a big discussion amongst the greats of that generation. And the Gemara is in fact not sure what the halacha should be, what the Jewish law should dictate in such a case. So now, being given that background, how do we understand what is the most proper way to act when we are faced with a dilemma? Now we're not so sure anymore. Now we're not so sure anymore. So the bottom line, the answer actually is, you have to be what we call, you have to calculate, you have to weigh out. You have to be bocher b'miut hara. Person, when he's faced with a dilemma, has to choose the lesser of the two evils. That is what Jewish law dictates. A person always has to choose. He has to size up the situation. Obviously, he has to be a great authority to be able to size up and calculate properly, but you have to size up the situation at hand and look at it in that perspective and understand what is going to bring about the lesser of the two evils. Sometimes the lesser of the two evils will be by being active. Sometimes that will bring about a better result than just by being passive and not doing anything. So that's what a person has to keep in mind. My father likes to quote the story. There was a great rabbi in Israel who passed away about 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. His name was Rav Shach. So he was a great leader. He was a big politician as well. Later in his career, he became a politician involved in Israeli politics. And when he decided to become involved in Israeli politics, the first time he told everybody to vote for a particular party, he was attacked mercilessly by a young schnook, as we call him, by a young person who now is considered an interesting personality. But at the time, he was very young, and this was one of the great sages of the generation that he was attacking, Rav Shach. So Rav Shach said, everybody should vote for this and this party in Israel. It was a political question. This young guy decided to publicly attack Rav Shach and say, how can you join with this party? They're against all the principles that we believe in. They're against everything we stand for. They're against everything we ever wanted. How can you vote with them? How can you put your cards in their basket? So Rav Shach didn't feel it was appropriate for him to respond to this young guy studying in a little kollel, studying in a little place over there. So he decided to write an open letter to the world on explaining his position of why he felt it's important that we should, in fact, vote for a particular political party in Israel. So he wrote the following. He said that, yes, kibalnu me rabuseinu, which means we have a tradition from our great rabbis, that whenever we're faced with a dilemma, the way to act is not simply by being passive. That's not always the answer. Rav Shach wrote very clearly that the answer is you have to be bocher b'miut hara. You have to choose the lesser of the two evils. So Rav Shach argued in a case like this, would you rather the Israeli government, this particular party, would you rather them just go wild and never take any consult with us and never include us in any decisions? Would you rather that? Or would you rather us put our cards in their basket and then maybe we'll be influential in actually making decisions that might be in our interests? Says Rav Shach, the answer to this dilemma is not by simply being passive. The answer is you have to weigh out both sides of the situation, you have to weigh out both options and figure out which is going to cause less damage. And Rav Shach himself, being a great decisor of Jewish law, he himself felt that the way to go would be to actively vote with this particular party, although they may not stand for the ideals and the stances we may have taken on our own. That's what Rav Shach understood, and this is also the way we find in other contexts as well. There was another great of a generation who lived at the same time as Rav Shach. His name was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So there's an interesting story that he was also a head of a yeshiva called Kol Torah in Beit Vegan in Israel, in Jerusalem. And the story goes that they were once having a dedication of a building, a Chanukah Sabayis. So they had a big to-do, and for anyone who's ever been in Israel, sometimes in the summer heat, in the middle of the afternoon, it could be very, very scorching hot. It could be very humid. And they had this dedication of a building in the middle of a very hot summer day. So the building was dedicated by an irreligious Jew who very graciously gave a lot of money to support this cause. And after the dedication was over, after the ceremony was over, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, also a great from the last generation, also died 15, 20 years ago. So he invited this family into his own home and he gave them to drink, he gave them to eat, and he sent them on their way. He had a long conversation with them and they continued on their way. So the students of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, a bunch of young guys also, started up with him and they said, how dare you give these people to drink? How dare you give them to eat? Don't you know that they're not going to recite a bracha? They're not going to recite a blessing? And the halacha dictates that one is not allowed to give something to a irreligious Jew to eat or to drink if he knows that he's not going to make a bracha. The halacha is that we're supposed to recite a bracha before one eats or before one drinks anything. Well, how are you allowed to facilitate that person to take something to eat or to take something to drink without reciting a blessing? You knew that in advance that they wouldn't, so how do you invite them into your home? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach responded, that's a number three, we'll speak it out outside, and he said no. Actually, let's read it together. I just think the words, just listen to the beautiful nature that a great Jewish decisor has. You feel the love that he has for everybody and the way he writes this. And this is for all posterity. This is not a private letter. This is something that was printed and that was sent all over the world in response to his students. He was actually very upset that his students had a question on what he had done. And he writes as follows. Hareza Dome, why did I do what I did? Because this type of dilemma is similar. Lemisha Kotea Etzbo Me Raglo Shel Chaveru. It's as if I would cut off the toe of somebody. Sometimes we have to do an amputation. I'm sure everyone in the room knows better than I ever will know. But sometimes you have to amputate one small part of a body in order that the person shouldn't lose his entire body, that he shouldn't lose his whole life. So said Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, de pashut hu de eino karei mazik ela misakein. What would you call that action when you do an amputation to save the rest of a body? Would you call that destructive? Or would you call that constructive? What would anyone say? It's the most constructive act a person can possibly do. Oh, but you're being active. But you're actively cutting someone's foot off. But you're actively amputating his arm. You're actively amputating his leg. Something. How are you allowed to do that? Says Rav Shlomo Zalman. What do you mean? Mitzvah hu dekavod v'lo avera. That is not an avera. That's not a transgression. There's no greater favor you could do for a person than to amputate a small part of his body in order to save the greater whole. Gam kan. So that's what he claims over here as well. In my situation. Eino chashev kemachshel ela adarabah. When I invited this couple into my home and I offered them graciously, I gave them everything they could have ever wanted. He says that is not a destructive act. I'm not facilitating something wrong by giving them to eat without reciting a bracha. He says, on the other hand, it's a lot worse if these people would walk away and say that this great rabbi didn't offer us anything to eat. That's much worse than anything we could have ever possibly have had from such a situation. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, just as we're saying, the answer to a dilemma is not always to be passive. He was faced with a dilemma. On the one hand, we know one is not allowed to facilitate a drink to somebody that he knows will not recite a blessing. On the other hand, imagine if these people walk away and say, look how terrible, look how much they don't care about us. Look how the rabbinic figures just don't care about us whatsoever. It's a scorching hot day, we just dedicated a building, they won't even offer us a drink. So which one is worse? What would you rather? Would you rather the people walk away with a wonderful taste, with a taste of love, with a taste of affection for Orthodox Jews? Or would you rather just be a stickler on the rule and say, be passive, sheva al tasa. Don't do anything, don't offer anything, and however the cards play out is how they're going to play out. This is a beautiful way. You just see from all this background that there's a complex way to figuring out how to deal with halachic dilemmas, with Jewish dilemmas. It's not always so simple. We don't always assume, just be passive and everything will be fine. That's not always the answer. And the same we find in a sefer called Pe'er Hador, written by the Chazon Ish, not written by him, but it's about him, that he also, we'll get back to his personality, the Chazon Ish, in a few minutes, also has an interesting spin on this whole topic. But he also felt the same way, that we don't always feel that the right answer is just to be passive and not to offer. We have to figure out how to weigh all the options carefully and really make sure that we're bringing the lesser of the two evils from a particular situation. So now, let's bring the conversation back into the Rabbi Wiener's question that we were discussing. And that is, I don't want to get into the particulars of this case, because really it's a generic case. I assume this happens in many different formulations throughout the year, correct? I assume there's many variations to this particular case, and that's why I just want to speak in a general sense. I'm just trying in this particular topic to give a little bit of an appreciation of how much goes into a decision that has to be made by a rabbinic figure when trying to deal with an end-of-life question that comes up. So we have, till now, a whole lot of sources that seem to indicate that being passive is not always the answer. Sometimes being active is the way to go. So now let's turn our conversation into the violation of Lo Sirtzach. One of the Ten Commandments is, one is not allowed to murder. Now let's figure out, first of all, how do we describe, how do we categorize this violation of murder? So, if you look in number 4 on the source sheet, I brought here the Kli Yakar, who is one of the commentaries on Chumash, he's one of the commentaries on the Tanakh, and he writes the same idea as the Ibn Ezra and many other greats of his generation. This was in the times of the Rishonim. He writes an interesting idea. I assume everyone in the room has seen a picture of the Ten Commandments, right? It's in two tablets, five on one side, five on the other side, right? Everybody's seen that. So is there any significance that there are five on this side, five on the other side, or do we assume that it's just arbitrary? This is just the way God made them. This is just the way they ended up. Five on this side, five on that side, looks nice and neat, nice and equal. Well, in fact, it's not so nice and neat because on the one side we have so many words, it's like many paragraphs, and on the other side we just have transgressions and violations that are just two words at a time. So it's not really so neat. So you can't just say that they ended up that way because that's the neat way to write them. So why, in fact, do we have five on one side, five on the other side? Says the Kli Yakar, we won't read it inside because it's not important to go exactly into the details of what he says, but I'll just give you the brief synopsis of what he's trying to tell us. Says the Kli Yakar, there is a great significance in the five on this side and five on the other side. The five that show up on the first side are between man and God. That's what we call Ben Adam Lamakum. For example, Anochi Hashem Elokecha is the first one of the Ten Commandments. You must serve God and nobody else. You cannot be interested in any other gods. Is that between man and his friend or between man and God? Obviously, that's between man and God. You go down the list, it says, Lo yelecha lokim acherim. Lo sasa lecha pesel. You're not allowed to make an idol. You have to make sure to keep the Shabbos, right? So these five examples, say the Rishonim, are all touching on issues that are between man and God. The only question they have is, how come honoring your parents is in that list? That seems to be between man and his friend, man and his parent. Why is that in the list? Why is that on the side of man and God? Okay, so that's a whole discussion, which is not for our topic today, but maybe another time we can discuss it or afterward if anyone's interested. Then you go to the other side of the tablets and you find five more commandments on the second side. And those five, say the Rishonim, say the commentaries on Chumash, those five are all between man and his fellow man. For example, Lo Sirtzach is the first one on the list. You may not murder. Is that between man and God or between man and his friend? That's between man and his friend. Obviously, God doesn't want us to do it. He's the one who's telling us. But that's an issue between man and his friend. Lo Signov, don't steal anything. That's not between me and God. That's between me and my friend. Don't steal his money. Don't take his property. So this is the underlying principle that we know. On the one hand, we have the five commandments which tell us ways to deal between us and God. On the other hand, we have five commandments which teach us how to deal between man and his fellow man. So now, we're faced with a problem. Because, in fact, on the list of five between man and his friend, as we said, is Lo Sirtzach. One may not murder. So that's between man and his friend. So take, for example, the other violations of man and his friend. Generally, when we discuss issues between people, so it's generally based on subjective nature. If my friend would like me to steal his money from him, right? If he asked me, please go to my house and steal my car. Okay, so being a good friend, I'll go to his house and steal his car. Please go to my house and steal my wallet. Okay, so then that's what I do. Do I violate anything if I do that? No. Everything between man and his friend is really subjective. So then, if that's in fact the case, that everything between man and his friend is subjective in nature, then we're faced with an issue when we get to the violation of Lo Sirtzach. What about euthanasia? What about euthanasia? Mercy killing. So somebody asked me, please take my life. I am not interested in living. I'm suffering tremendously. We've all seen this. We have patients in a hospital who suffer to no end. And they ask us, please, not just the DNR. DNR is different. DNR just means, I guess, don't extend. But this is talking about a case of mercy killing. The person asked me, as a good friend, please take my life. I'm not interested in living anymore. This is too difficult. Or I'm depressed. I don't have a life. I never was successful. My children are a problem. Everything. He asked his fellow friend, as a good friend of mine, please take my life and that will be the end of me. Am I allowed to do that? Well, this finds itself on the five of the Aseres HaDibros on the side which is all between man and his friend. And generally when we deal with issues between man and his friend, that is of subjective nature. So if that's the case, we should assume that the issue of murdering should also be subjective. And if somebody asked me to do a mercy killing, should that be permissible or not? Any ideas? So what would we say? What is the Jewish position on mercy killing? No. Why not? Does everyone appreciate the question at least? I think the question is a very strong one. I think the question is a very, very strong one. It's a very serious question. Yeah.
Because God gives life, it's not the person's life to give.
Oh, so that's a very, very astute observation. In fact, the Radvaz, one of the commentaries on the Rambam, points that out. He says, Hanafashos li hena. He says, the souls belong to me, God says. They don't belong to you. Your life doesn't belong to you. You don't have a right to make that choice, whether or not someone should take your life. Okay, that's an interesting, idea, but the question is, why does that make me violate murder? That makes you in the wrong. I don't mean you, I just mean that makes the person who asked for the mercy killing, God forbid, no one should ever be involved in such a thing, but the person who asked for the mercy killing, that makes him in the wrong. But why does that make me as the murderer in the wrong? I'm doing something which he very much wants. I'm being a good friend. I'm doing what he asked of me. So why is that wrong? Why is that in nature? Why is that something that's considered wrong by Jewish law? So the answer can be found. This is a Sefer Haksav HaKabbalah written by Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, who was a close correspondent of Rabbi Kiva Eger in the 1800s. And he suggests the following. If we can follow along in number 5, there's a pasuk, there's a scripture in Parshas Noach, right in the beginning of the Torah. So the psukim tell us about taking somebody else's life. This is all the way at the beginning of creation, right by the flood. As we all know the story of the Mabul and Noach, when he survived the flood. So right after that, we are told the following. One has to value life. Va'achas dimchem l'nafsho seichem edrosh. I will be careful never to commit suicide because I will hold you accountable for committing suicide. Edrosh, meaning I will look into the matter. If somebody decides to take their own life, if somebody decides to commit suicide, I will look after that person and I will surely punish him. How can he be punished? It means we believe in an afterlife. So one will be punished in the afterlife for committing suicide. But then there's a couple of strange words in the end of this scripture. Says the pasuk, Miyad ha'adam, miyad ish achiv, edrosh es nefesh ha'adam. Seems to be very repetitive. It says on the one end, I will take... If somebody takes the life of his friend, if somebody takes the life of somebody else, why are we repeating so many words? We know that the Torah is so careful never to repeat words that aren't necessary. Why is it important for the Torah to repeat this over here again and say on the one hand, Miyad ish Adam, or Miyad ish Achim? Why is this something that's repeated? Says the Ksav HaKabbalah, will speak it out. He suggests the following. When we discuss just my relationship with somebody else, I decide I'm going to take his life because he has a couple of $1 million in his wallet, he's holding a bunch of diamonds, I want them. So I go and I shoot him in the middle of the street, that obviously is murder, no one's going to disagree. But what happens when it's a mercy killing? What happens when we discuss the question of euthanasia? And now, I'm taking his life not because I hate him. I'm taking his life because I love him. I'm taking his life because I feel so bad for his situation. And I respect his opinion so much. I respect his wishes so much. That is the reason why I take his life. What do you say in a case like that? Can you call me a murderer? Or can you call me the nicest friend one can ever have? Over here, the pasuk makes sure to repeat, Miyad ish achiv, even if he's my brother, even if he's someone who's so close to my heart, and he's somebody who I love so much, he's somebody who I would do anything for, even in a case like that, God assures us, Edrosh es nafsho seichem, I will look into the matter, and I will hold you accountable for murder in such a case, even if you're doing it out of mercy, even if you're doing it out of love, that is still called murder. Actively murdering someone is called murder as well. So that's just before we figure out how to deal with dilemmas and end-of-life issues, we have to make sure that we have clear that murdering is considered murdering, actively murdering is considered a murder, whether it's done out of love or it's done out of hate. Whether it's done to somebody that we like very much or somebody that we hate very much, that is something that we consider murder. Yes?
So, in real life, that's the way I'm an ICU doctor, we don't deal exactly the example that you gave, Rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
What we deal with is that continuation of the torment, the way I see it. And so, if I understood you correctly, and please correct me, that you're saying that if I prolong someone's suffering, tormentation, actively, if I promote that, is that okay?
Excellent. That's a segue right into our next point. Thank you. You must have prepared this together with her. But thank you. The Rav Moshe Feinstein, who just passed away also 25 years ago, he was probably the greatest decisor of Jewish law in modern history, in America for sure, probably in Israel as well. But he writes a very famous opinion that he has, that if, let's say, somebody is suffering and you're going to prolong their treatment, which will make them suffer even more, we're not talking about pulling the plug or something like that, but actively giving them more medications, putting them on more machines that they weren't on before, that says Rav Moshe Feinstein, you're not doing him a favor. You are actually held accountable for hurting that individual, unless he has a directive which says, I want to be extended at all costs. Some people want that. Some people feel that the quality of life, even if it's going to be horrible, is worth having, even if life is going to be full of suffering, even if life is going to be full of hardships. I don't care, this is what I want. Okay, that's what the person wants, that's what he wants. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in that responsa as well, that if you have an individual who says that, but most of the world wouldn't want that. Most of the world would say, with such suffering, I'd rather not live. You don't listen to that individual. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean I'm allowed to go ahead and pull the plug? No. Doesn't mean I'm allowed to actively go ahead and stop, you know, just pull everything out? No. All it means is I don't have to extend. It means I don't have to go ahead and give more treatments than he was getting before. I don't have to go ahead, in many cases, obviously we have to ask rabbinic authorities when it comes to each individual case because there are many different moving parts in each case, but I don't have to actively go ahead and refill the medication. I don't have to go ahead and refill the IV. I don't have to go ahead and make him have a prolonged suffering. I think that addresses your question. Very often to the contrary, when it's dealing with suffering, we don't assume that that's considered ritzicha. We don't assume that's considered a bad activity. On the other hand, we feel that lessening the suffering as much as we can without actively killing the person, just passively letting him go, sometimes is the way to go. Now, I just want to bring this into a little bit not so current events, but 1967, okay, current enough, when there was a famous, this is the last point I want to make before we close up. Are we doing okay with time? Anyone have to leave? Everyone's okay? All right, so let's just go a little bit further. I think this is an interesting point just to think about, just to sharpen our understanding of what we're dealing with when it comes to end-of-life issues. There was an essay that was published in 1967 by Professor Philippa Foot. I assume many of us have heard of him. No? Right? About the doctrine of the double effect? No? Anyone familiar? Not familiar? Okay, so he basically was dealing with dilemmas, and let's read it together. Number 6 in English. I assume everyone can read English. Okay, for anyone who can't, we'll say it in Hebrew. So, here we go. So, we have, this is from the Doctrine of the Double Effect, written by Professor Philippa Foot, where he discusses the following case. There is a runaway trolley barreling down a railway tracks. Ahead on the tracks, there are 5 people tied up and unable to move. The trolley is headed straight for them. Okay, so far you have this train that's just going toward the 5 people. You are standing some distance off in the train yard next to a lever. If you pull this lever, the trolley will switch to a different set of tracks. Unfortunately, you notice that there is one person on the sidetrack. What would we call this in English? Dilemma. You have 2 options. Number 1, do nothing. As we said, just be passive. Sheva al tase, and the trolley kills the 5 people on the main track. Okay, just let things take their course. 5 people, unfortunately, will lose their lives. Number 2, option number 2 is pull the lever, diverting the trolley onto the sidetrack, which parenthetically, let's just remember, that's an active way of being involved in this case, where it will kill one person, obviously actively. Which is the correct choice? Now, this is a big discussion that we know has been a philosophical discussion for many years since 1967 when this was raised. I want everyone to know that he was not the one who came up with this. The Chazon Ish, who died in 1953. The Chazon Ish was a great leader who lived in Israel, and died in 1953. He already has this published in his books before 1967 when Philippa Foot put out his article. So everything somehow dates back to the Torah, if you just look carefully enough. So here, it's exactly the same case. The Chazon Ish has in his responsa, which is printed in 1950, he died in 1953, it was printed 1 or 2 years after he passed away, he writes the following case. Obviously, in the Holocaust, they had also a similar case, which is discussed in different books, about there were a bunch of people hiding, for example, hiding in a little hideout. Obviously, they held their breaths when the Nazis were coming around looking for them, and one young child began to cry. So another individual who was there stuffed a pillow into his mouth and suffocated the child. Obviously, it wasn't on purpose, but he ended up murdering the child. Is that something that's permissible or not? Is that something that we're allowed to do? Obviously, it's considered active killing. That's a real act of killing. Unfortunately, the circumstances, people weren't thinking sometimes as they should have been, which no one could be blamed. Obviously, we've never lived through it, and we never should. But that was an unfortunate situation which found itself coming up many times throughout the Holocaust. Am I considered a murderer for example, suffocating that young child who's about to make us all lose our lives? If the Nazis hear this young child crying, they're going to kill everybody. If this young child is killed, then we'll all be saved, because the Nazis will just pass through the house and they'll move on. So this is an interesting question that came up, and in fact the Chazon Ish discusses the question of Philippofoot, exactly the same question, in his responsa that came out way before this article was printed. And that is the following question. He had a train driver that actually came to him, and he said, theoretically, if I was riding a train, and I am conducting, and I see that there's a construction worker in front of me, and there's a whole team of workers right here, on the other hand, I can push it to the side, exactly the same case. I could push it to the side, Philippofoot must have taken it from him. I could take it to the side and kill one individual on the other side. The Chazon Ish conceptualizes this and says, what happens in olden terms if you have someone shoots a bow and arrow, right? Someone shoots an arrow or shoots a bullet. I mean, it's not so common, you can't really do it with a bullet. But basically he says, there's an arrow that's going straight at a person, and I could allow it to go straight, and it will go straight through a whole crowd of people and kill a whole bunch of individuals. On the other hand, I could somehow divert the bullet, somehow divert the arrow, and make it just hit a few less people. This came up by 9/11 as well. It was a big discussion. There was a notice that went out to the police department, or the, I don't know who was in charge exactly by 9/11, who was running the show, but basically a notice went out that any plane that you see flying over certain places should be shot down immediately. That's effectively the same case, right? You have 200-300 people on a plane. They're going to be shot down immediately. They're all going to obviously die, but it's at the expense, you're obviously saving a whole big, you know, World Trade Center. You're saving a whole big office building that may have killed thousands and thousands of people. So that's a question. Is this something which we are allowed to do or not? The Chazon Ish postulates, he says this is a possibility, but he doesn't say this with complete certainty. The Chazon Ish suggests, perhaps when we're dealing with a case like that, perhaps you can't call this, you can't categorize that as an act of murder. Perhaps I call that an act of savior, an act of salvation. When I do something like that, when I shoot down a plane that's going for a World Trade Center, you're going to call me a murderer? Or you're going to call me a hero for saving the hundreds of thousands of people that are going to be affected when that plane hits a tower? Right? So how do we look at that? It's a very interesting case. How do we look at that? Says the Chazon Ish, one is supposed to look at that. You can look at number 7 later, but just out of the interest of time, we'll move on. The Chazon Ish already discusses this case, and he says, perhaps we can assume that in a case like this, we can really classify that as an act of heroism and not an act of murder. This is something which is interesting. It throws just a different, it's a curveball in this whole discussion here. Generally, we are assuming that act of murder is act of murder. And yes, sometimes when we're faced with a dilemma, you have to choose the lesser of the two evils, but when it comes to murder, murder is murder, and it doesn't make a difference. Even if the lesser of the two evils would be to be actively murdering, murder is murder. And even if it's mercy killing, murder is murder, you're never allowed to do it. Well, what happens in a case like this where you're actually, through the murder, saving a whole bunch of other people? That is what the Chazon Ish questions. Maybe we should assume in a case like that, that might be permissible because that would be an act of heroism and not an act of murder. An interesting thing to think about, and with this, I just want to close, that the later authorities picked up on this idea of the Chazon Ish, and they had an interesting case that happened as well. There was a military building in Israel that was bombed out. Somehow it fell down. It was a 5-story building, and there were like a couple of hundred soldiers on the bottom level of the building, and only 5 or 6 on the top level. So the whole building collapsed, the whole building imploded, and basically everyone was caught under the rubble. They assumed that the impact from the fall was not so bad. They assumed many, many of the soldiers survived. So again, there were a couple of hundred soldiers on the bottom, just a few number of soldiers on the top floor, and that was the discussion that was raised just a couple of years ago. Are we allowed to come in with a tractor and basically clear out the rubble from the top floors in order to get to the hundreds of soldiers that will be on the bottom? Now, obviously, it's unfortunate to talk about such cases, but obviously when you do such a thing, if you come in with a tractor, you're obviously going to kill the individuals, the 5-6 people that are on the top level, right? If you ride over them with a tractor, that's generally something that a human being can't handle. So that was the question that was raised, the unfortunate question, is a person allowed to come ahead with a device to clear out the rubble, whereby he will be saving the hundreds of people that are underneath on the bottom floor of the structure? Or should we assume no? Person has to be active. You go ahead and save the couple of individuals on the top. And even if it's at the expense of the hundreds of people on the bottom losing their life, that is something that we are not allowed to do because active murder is active murder. Again, this is the same question that the Chazon Ish raised when it came to the train. Same question as Philippa Foot as well. So this is in number 8. That's where the question, I just wrote it out for us, just to remember. That is a question that was asked to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach as well as Rabbi Yashiv. Rabbi Yashiv just passed away a year ago. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, we quoted before. Very sensible individuals who felt that murder is murder. The bottom line is, not like the Chazon Ish. Murder is murder. And even sometimes, if you're going to try to put it in perspective, and you're going to think that by doing this act, you're going to save many other people along the way, and maybe that should weigh out the options. Again, we said in the beginning of our talk that when you're faced with a dilemma, sometimes being bocher b'miyad hara, you have to choose the lesser of the two evils. And even if that means being active, sometimes that's what you have to do. But when it comes to murder, we don't have that option. That's the way we assume according to Jewish law. When it comes to murder, you don't have the right to choose between the lesser of the two evils. Actively murdering someone is actively murdering. A person always has to be passive when it comes to a case like that. Let's just close with a little bit of a lighter, note. It's really a great honor to be here, and I thank you for inviting me to address the wonderful individuals that are in the room. You know, there's a discussion at the time when God wanted to give the Torah. So it says that he went to many different nations, and he asked, do you want it? Would you like it? Would you like to accept it? So we're told that he went to the nation of Esav. He went to the family of Esav, and he asked them, are you interested in accepting the Torah? So he said, well, tell us something that it says in there. So Esav responds, God responds to them, well, it says you're not allowed to murder. Esav says, well, our whole definition, our whole life is murdering. Obviously, I'm not pinning this on anyone. You know, we don't know exactly who Esav is, but the psukim, the scriptures tell us, al charba chatichya. The whole life of Esav is, you know, this is what they live off. They live off terrorism, off murder. This is something that they're very familiar with. So Esav turns God down and he says, no, we have a predisposition to murder. Sorry, this is something we're not comfortable with. We won't be able to accept the Torah. Okay, so God moves on, goes to this nation, that nation. Finally, he comes to the Jews. The Jews say, we'll accept it right away. No questions asked. Everything's fine. So some of the commentaries point out, well, God decides that he loves the Jewish people so much just because they decided to accept the Torah? Maybe we don't have any predisposition that opposes anything that the Torah says. It's not Esav's fault. God gave Esav a predisposition toward murder. So that's why Esav couldn't accept it. If God would have given us some sort of predisposition that was against something that the Torah says, maybe we also would have said no. So why does God love us so much just because we accepted his Torah? No? Fair question. It's not equal. The two choices really aren't equal, right? Esav has a predisposition starkly against something that the Torah says. Maybe we don't. So the Chiddush Harim, one of the Hasidic masters, points out that if you look in the Psukim, you look in the scriptures right before God gave us the Torah, what does it say? It says, Hagbel Esahar V'Kidashto. At the time of the giving of the Torah, there was a directive that there were levels that had to be made. If you were this type of person, you can only go this far. You know, it was given on Mount Sinai. And not everyone was just able to run up the mountain and go touch the Torah on their own and go have an encounter with God. Yes, God came to all of us, and everyone in the room was there at some point. Everyone's soul was there. But it's not that we all had the right to jump up and touch God or to experience him as close as other people may have. There were levels that had to be made. There were restrictions that had to be made. There was a fence that was put up around the mountain, and most regular people in the Jewish nation were not able to go past the fence. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses went up the mountain, and he's the one who accepted. The ones who were a little bit lower than him, they went a little bit closer. But the rest of us who are just regular, we're all regular. So we just stood at the foot of the mountain. Said the Chiddush Harim, that is against our predisposition. We, as Jewish people, have the predisposition to always push, to always grow, to always, not push in the physical sense, but to always experience and to always understand more, to always try to push our boundaries in our understanding of different matters. And when we talk about being invited to a hospital to discuss an issue and to try to give more clarity, I hope I gave some sort of clarity on this matter. I hope I gave some sort of background and understanding into the issue that obviously is something we take very seriously. But there's no more beautiful a way for me to spend my time in Los Angeles than to sit here and to deal with our predisposition, to push our logic farther, to push our understanding, to make sure we understand as deeply as we possibly can, and to try to give a greater context to the issues that we deal with so often in Jewish law. And I thank you again for inviting me. If anyone has any questions, we'll take a few questions. Oh, you could have gone a long time ago, hey. Okay, yeah. Okay, so thank you very much, everybody, and it was really a pleasure. Have a great day.